All right, let's keep moving forward here. We're in chapter 3, more about alcoholism. And as we go through this, especially this first part, man, we got to look at the words Bill uses, because I love the way he writes. I mean, he could have used any old word, but he uses specific words to drive home a point, and we're going to talk about some of these. More about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. Isn't that kind of funny, though? Back when I was in college, I'd tell you I was an alcoholic. Right? I didn't know what it meant, but I was assured I was an alcoholic. It was fun. It was great. It was an achievement of sorts. But later on in my life, you ask me how much I've been drinking. Oh, I just had a couple. I just had a little. Now, meanwhile, vodka's spewing out of my pores, but oh, I just had a couple. You know? I don't want to admit I was a real alcoholic. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. The allergy, the mental obsession. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. We got some provers in here? By God, you're going to prove today that this time you can drink like a gentleman. Right? I'm going to prove to you that I am not a stinking drunk. I'm going to prove to you, and here's how. Countless vain attempts. The idea that somehow, someday, he'll control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Right? There's my mental obsession. What's my obsession? Somehow I'm going to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was controlling it, I sure as heck wasn't enjoying it. If I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. But my obsession is that this time I'm going to control and enjoy it. It's an obsession. Not a good word. Obsession. It's like in my apartment complex, if a pretty girl moves into the apartment next to me and I think she's really nice and I want to get to know her and I take her some flowers or whatever and introduce myself and I'm trying to build a relationship and she don't want to have anything to do with me, right? And then I start following her to the gym and to her work and I become obsessed with her. Stalker. They call that stalking, exactly, right? That's an obsession. It's unhealthy. Right? I can't get my mind away from it. Think back to one of those times when you weren't drinking. What were you thinking about? Not drinking. Thinking about how you're going to drink. How are you going to control and enjoy it? And look at this next one. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. This illusion. What's my illusion? That I can control and enjoy it. Well, let's ask the question. What is an illusion? If I turn this book into a parakeet, did I really do it or did I trick you? What's an illusionist do? He makes me see things that aren't real. Come on, y'all didn't fall. David Copperfield made the Statue of Liberty disappear? No, it was an illusion. He tricked us. My illusion is that I can control and enjoy it. It's an illusion. It ain't happening. It's not real. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. Again, when I was 15, started drinking, dying from it or going insane from it wasn't on the horizon. But fast forward to 1999, where was it taking me? To the gates of insanity or death. We learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. I had to concede. Concede and surrender, I think, are two different things. Hell, Germany surrendered in World War I, didn't they? I don't think they conceded, did they? They started it back up 30 years later, didn't they? After World War II, they conceded. They were bombed back to the Stone Age, right? They conceded. I got to concede to my innermost selves. No lurking notion. I got to run through all my plans. I got to concede in my little heart of hearts that I am the real deal. Getting the job, the car, the girls, not going to fix it. Winning the lottery, ain't going to fix it. Getting the law off my back is not going to fix it. I got to concede to my innermost selves. It says this is the first step in recovery. The delusion, there's another good word, the delusion that I'm like my brother has to be smashed. The delusion that I'm like a normal man has to be smashed. How did that delusion get smashed for me? Well, I did a lot of smashing on my own, but where that delusion was smashed was September the 4th, 1999, sitting directly across from me was somebody who was just like me. And he asked me some questions about drinking, told me some stories about himself, asked me some questions about me. He smashed my delusions that I was going to be like a normal person. The delusion that we're like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Can't control it. Says we know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. You know, you can't put the genie back into the bottle. You know, that's the way it is. Says all of us felt at times we were gaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time, underline this, to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We hear a lot of talk about bottoms in AA. Well, you haven't hit your bottom. You haven't hit your bottom. I hit my bottom a lot of times. But that's the good one, the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It's not the DWIs and all that. It's that inside stuff. That inside, that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We're convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grips of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. As I drink, you know, when I was 17 years old drinking, I could stay up till 3 or 4 in the morning or in college, do the same thing and get a couple hours of sleep, get up in the morning, shake off the cobwebs, have a little coffee and go on my merry way, right? I could do that. But our bodies get older. Right? We don't react the way we used to. We don't recover the way we used to. Alcohol is destroying our bodies from the inside out. And I don't get better. It doesn't matter how long is in between my last drink. My body's still getting older. And the older I get, the less recuperative powers I have. And I'm going to get worse, never better. Doesn't matter how long I've not drank. My illness right here today is progressing. It's progressing. Why? Because I'm getting older. We're like men who've lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We've tried every imaginable remedy. Hell, science is trying every imaginable remedy. They've tried everything, right? We were talking to people after our last little deal. You know, talking about the LSD stuff, right? Fast forward to the 60s, they came up with a new drug called Valium. That was going to do it. Then Xanax.
Yeah.
You know, then this. The hell, the only thing science has done is they've created new 12-step programs. Right? Every drug that they've used to try to fix us has just created another 12-step program. Well, Valium is booze and a pill. Same damn thing. Huh. I tried every imaginable remedy. It's insane. In some instances, there was brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Remember, we get worse, never better. That's what baffled Silk were. Bill comes in to see him. Bill's in bad shape. They counsel him. They nurse him back to health. Talk to him about alcoholism. Don't drink. Don't drink. Bill leaves. I'm never going to drink again. He leaves. Short amount of time, he drinks. He comes back. He's in worse shape. I always get worse. Says physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there's no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. I'm sure they're trying to work on it, but they haven't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove to themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. Right? I'm going to try every form of self-deception I have to prove to you that I'm not an alcoholic. Oh, remember we were going to the concert in 1984 and I was the driver? I didn't get drunk, see? Or by some miracle, I at a Mexican food restaurant and only had like 10 beers and 10 shots of Cuervo and I didn't throw up. And see, I'm normal. I'm going to try every form of self-deception. Take the little, remember when they had the shit treatment centers back in the 70s and stuff? They did the little shit test on TV and they asked you all those questions. And I'm trying to lie to the TV, right? I'm lying to the freaking TV. Nope, I don't do that. Nope, I'm yes all down the board. But I'm trying to lie to myself, convince myself that I'm not an alcoholic. If anyone who is showing the inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats off to him. Hey, if you can pull up and stop drinking, God love you, go for it. I hope it works out well for you. I am not that guy. Cannot pull that off. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. See if you've tried these. Drinking beer only. Limiting the number of drinks. Never drinking alone. Never drinking in the morning. Drinking only at home. Never having it at the house. Never drinking during business hours. Drinking only at parties. Switching from scotch to brandy. Drinking only natural wines. Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Taking a trip. Not taking a trip. Swearing off forever, with and without solemn oath. Taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms, sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. He's been to my house. You should see my bookshelf, man. It is great, man. It's so cool. Because I've got every friggin' self-help book there is from back in the day, man. I got the Tai Chi books. I've got Tony Robbins. I've got Zig Ziglar. I got it all on all this stuff of how to make yourself into a better man. I tried everything under the sun. Because I thought, if I just had the right workout program and had the right diet and read the right books and did enough good deeds that I could beat this alcohol, I tried everything. Failed every time. Every time. We do not like to pronounce anyone an individual or any individual as an alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Hell, the deadliest disease known to mankind, alcoholism. You got to diagnose yourself. Ain't that a trip? Got to diagnose yourself. Hell, people were telling me I was alcoholics for years. I had to diagnose myself. Huh. So here's a little test. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It'll not take long for you to decide if you're honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of the jitters if you get full knowledge of your condition. I was going to a psychiatrist and he was going on vacation for a week or whatever. And I'm trying to keep this little busted up relationship together and we're on one-on-one and he says, and we're getting around to all the drinking stuff, and I wasn't copping to that I was an alcoholic. And he said, okay, we're going to do a little test. I'll be back. Your next appointment is like 8 or 9 days. So he says, what do you like to drink? What's your favorite drink? And I said, vodka, martini, straight up. Right? He says, great. Pick a number of drinks. And I said, 3. He says, great. So for the next 8 days while I'm on vacation, I want you to drink 3 vodka martinis. No more, no less. And we'll talk about it when I get back.
Yeah.
Great. So I go down to the liquor store. I'm looking for my favorite brand of vodka, which at the time was Absolut Vodka. Just so happened that they had the 1.75 liters on sale. I am a conscious bargain shopper. I got to take the bargain, right? So I get the big bottle of vodka, go put it in the freezer. I wait for the end of the day, pour my first... Now, I kind of thought I tricked him because I said 3 martinis. I didn't say how big the glass was, right? So I drank that first one, and then that experiment went so marvelously well that I had my second martini. And that went down so smooth that I had my third one. And by the third one, what I realized, it was a bad test day because I had triggered that allergy. I ended up drinking that whole bottle, and I drank a bottle thereafter till we met again. I cannot control my drinking. Can't do it. Put a gun to my head. I'll wait till you fall asleep. I'll drink. Cannot control my drinking. There's no way of proving it. Though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But why? 19 years old, I was at my first counselor. They were trying, and I was lying through my teeth on how much I drink, and I still came up as a normal drinker. I was not going to stop drinking because I was not in trouble. My mama was just on my back. I was not going to stop drinking because booze worked. Booze fixed everything. When it was a good time, booze made it better. When it was a bad time, it made it tolerable. Booze worked. I was not going to stop. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We have heard of a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here's one. So now they're going to start giving us some examples. All right? Examples of different kinds of drunks. All right? So here's this guy. He says, a man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He is very nervous in the morning. A lot of nervous people back in the 30s, if you read this book. A lot of nervous people, man. So he was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. That's what I did when I was nervous. Half a bottle of vodka in the morning will get those nerves right back on track. Right? He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he had started, he had no control whatever. So he's powerless, right? Don't you think? He made up his mind that until he'd been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. So this guy saw that he was in trouble. He was drinking too much when he started drinking, but he had an overpowering desire to succeed. And he said, you know what? I'm not going to get this if I keep drinking, so I'm going to stop drinking. Was his life unmanageable? No. He stopped. He stopped for 25 years. It says after a successful and happy business career. It may have been happy for him, but I bet he was an intolerable you-know-what, man. You've seen the angry drunk in the meeting, right? Hadn't had a drink for 25 years, but God dang, it'd probably help him out if he did, you know. We know they had those people in Kansas too, don't they? Yeah, we know that guy, right? Good God. You see those people at the family reunion. Well, Jim Bob over here is an alcoholic. He hadn't touched a drop in 30 years, and Jim Bob looks like he's about to spin out of control, you know. Pissed off, man. All right, but so let's see what happens to this guy. Then he fell victim to the belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that after his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. So after 25 years, he retired and his brain comes up with the brilliant solution. Any man who retired as successful as you and hadn't had a drink in 25 years deserves a cocktail. Out came the carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. Well, they don't tell us in the story, but as far as we know, he hadn't been to the hospital before. He just knew he couldn't control his liquor. Now he drinks for 2 months and he's already in the hospital. Sounds like it progressed, didn't it? Even though he wasn't drinking for 25 years. He tried to regulate his drink. Do we got some regulators in here? Trying to limit those number of drinks? Just drink a little bit? Try to taper yourself off? I can't taper, man. You can't do it, you know? It ain't going to work. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. So he's going to the hospital repeatedly. It's not working out too well for this guy. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. So he put his foot down. I ain't never going to do it again. I'm stopping altogether. I've done it before. Watch me. He could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. He had it all. Best doctors you could get. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Wow. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us believe that if we remain sober for a long enough stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. That's an illusion. But here's a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink, and here's a promise, commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in short time as bad as ever. And we did that little show of hands earlier. We've had some people in here with some sobriety and they relapse, right? In a short amount of time, I'm on the rocks. Very, very short. If we're planning to stop drinking, underline this, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol. No lurking notion. Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop as he did on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can, because none will really want to stop. And hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find that he can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, have been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who've been drinking 20 years. And man, I remember seeing that nonsense so many times. Well, when I first went to AA in my mid-20s, old-timers were telling me, you hadn't drank enough. I spilt more booze than you ever drank. We don't say that. We don't say that in our group. We don't say that. That's crap. You go to our group, we got a kid who's got like 3 years sober and he looks like he's 12. We got some big book thumpers and they're late teens. I mean, I'll stack up them against any big book thumper out there. They are a joy to be around. They hit it early, young, hard, and they got here quick. You know, they got their entire lives ahead of them. You know, it's flat out amazing. And, you know, I'd be pretty insensitive if I looked at them and said, I drank more than you ever drank. No, it don't matter. If you're here, you're here. You know? To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time nor take the quantities some of us have. Now, I read a story in one of these archive things that I got. This lady was in surgery. You know, back in the 50s, you got out of surgery, the doctor may give you a little shot of brandy or whatever with to which, you know, to recuperate. They did that stuff back in the day, right? Lady had never touched a drop. Alcoholism in her family, never touched a drop, went in for some little surgery or whatever. She's in her hospital room recuperating, and part of the prescription from her doctor was to have a glass of brandy. Never touched a drop. She drank the glass of brandy. They heard a commotion a little while later, and she was breaking into the nurse's closet to get more brandy. From the very first shot. Just waiting for a drink. Didn't know what was wrong with her. She was waiting for a drink, though, you know. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers who'd be greatly insulted if called alcoholics are astonished at their inability to stop. We who are familiar with the symptoms see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try to get them to see it. As we look back, we feel we've gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. Later on in the book, they call it a tedious process, right? I went way, many, many years beyond this, you know, just like it says here. If anyone here's another test. If anyone questions whether he has entered the dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. Just don't drink for a year, right? If he's a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there's scant chance of success. You're saying you ain't going to pull it off if you're a real alcoholic. You won't do it. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. That sounds kind of confusing, but, you know, maybe we could have stopped. Maybe I could have stopped after that first treatment center. Maybe I could have. If I would have got plugged into the program and did the steps, maybe I could have stopped then. I didn't want to stop. And the truth be known was I couldn't stop. I had to drink no matter what. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay anything dry like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolutions, most of them within a few weeks. Make a firm resolution, never ever to do it again. A short amount of time goes by, I'm not going to remember how bad it was, I drink. That's what happens. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is, now here's the question, is how do you stop altogether? How do you stop? That is the million-dollar question, right? How is it that we stop drinking altogether? We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. I have this underlined. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he'll drink or not. Page 24 says, within a week or a month, I'm not going to remember how bad it was. Within a week or a month of my last drink. See, this is why sometimes treatment centers are a catch-22. We like the 30-day stay. It gets them back to health, right? But after a 30-day stay, if I'm not into the work while I'm in treatment center, by the time I get out of treatment centers, I got 30 days under my belt. 30 days of food, 30 days for my ego and my arrogance to rekindle itself, and I'm bulletproof again. It just depends on to the point of have I lost the power to choose whether or not I drink. It says, many of us felt we had plenty of character. There's a lot of characters in AA. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. That is unmanageability. The utter inability to leave it alone. That is why my life's unmanageable. How then shall we help our readers to determine to their own satisfaction whether or not they are one of us? Right? So they're giving us some tests, and they're giving us these stories. They're identifying with us. Why? So that we can determine if we belong. Makes good sense to me. The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously that's the crux of the problem. Right? What sort of thinking dominates the alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? What sort of thinking is that? That's insane thinking, because I'm doing the same thing. Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. You know, that's why our families looked at us like our heads were on fire when they bail us out of jail or we lose the job and we're crashing on their couch or whatever, and we get a little clean time into us and we walk directly to the liquor store. Because they're thinking that drinking has just cost you your job, your family, your kids, and you walk right back into a bar. Huh. Why does he do this? Or of what is he thinking? So I love this example, Jim. All right, Jim's a good old boy, right? So let's see where Jim's wheels fall off on here, all right? Because Jim's got a good story. Jim's a low-bottom guy, right? Drinking costs Jim a lot. Our first example is a friend we should call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. Sounds pretty good. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. That's like in Dallas. He inherited Sewell Village Cadillac. He inherited something good. That's a good thing, right? I mean, that'd be great to. I wish I inherited an automobile agency, right? He had a commendable World War record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal as far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. Old Jim's got the nerves again, right? On paper so far, Jim seems like a pretty sharp guy. Pretty sharp guy, right? He did no drinking until he was 35. So he was a late bloomer. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. Drinking disagrees with Jim. Right? It ain't working out too well for Jim on that. On leaving the asylum, he's already going to asylums, right? He came into contact with us, so he met the AAers, right? This is what they did. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. He made a beginning. Well, what do they say about that? I mean, we're taken to assume, what did he make? Did he do a third step? Maybe he had done a fourth step. Maybe he's working on his fourth step. He made a beginning, right? His family was reassembled. There's another good thing. He began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. There's a red flag right there. I inherited the automobile dealership, and now I'm working there. Oh, no. That's not going to work for me. That's a resentment right there. I got a resentment for Jim. You know what I mean? I'm doing it for him. That pisses me off just thinking about it. Jim, you had it all. You know? Let's see. Where did I... Okay. All went well for a time, right? All went well for a time. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So Jim's a middle of the roader. Jim ain't calling his sponsor. Jim's not working on his four step. Jim's not helping anybody else. Jim's not doing any of the work. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with them. Right? So the good AAs went to help Jim, reviewing carefully what had happened. So they said, Jim, what happened? Why didn't you call? Why weren't you at the big book study? Why aren't you at the hospital helping drunks? What happened? He agreed he was a real alcoholic in serious condition. He knew, he knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he'd lose his family for whom he had deep affection. Jim's got every reason in the world not to pick up a drink and to hook up with these AAers, don't he? Every reason in the world. Yet he got drunk again. Poor Jim. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. Red flag. What the hell happened to Monday? I mean, you got to ask yourself that question. I mean, my old boss back in the day, they didn't even schedule me on Mondays. They knew I wasn't going to be there, right? Jim, it sounds like he was on the schedule. He shows up Tuesday. You know, something happened. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. Jim's got a little resentment going. Probably a little hungover going into the place that he used to own. You know it's grinding him. It's grinding him. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Jim, where in the hell were you Monday? Jim thinking to himself, I used to own you. You know? But Jim writes, but look what he says. He minimizes. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Isn't that what we do?
No facts.
Oh, it's nothing.
No facts.
Who sponsored a guy when he got to the forceps and they said, oh, I don't have any resentment? Get out of here. Hey, if I got you drunk, you'd tell me all about it. You know? Oh, now that you're sober in treatment, you ain't got no resentments. Come on. All right. So, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive to the country and see one of my prospects for a car, right? So back in the olden days, we all didn't have cars. So if you had to sell a car in the 1930s, you had to drive to where the people were, right? So pretty normal so far. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. They tell me back in the day, everywhere you stopped, every restaurant, they all had a bar. I mean, that was just the way we did business back in the day. So everything's cool here, right? Normal stuff. I had no intention of drinking. He didn't. He's pissed off at his boss and his life, but he had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I'd been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Pretty normal. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Jim's hungry, right? Two sandwiches and two glasses of milk. It's in italics. If it's in italics, it's in the big book. You know it's important. Suddenly, he had no intention of drinking. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it wouldn't hurt me on a full stomach. Insane. Because if it ain't going to hurt you, why do it? Just insane, right there. I ordered a whiskey, poured into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart. But felt reassured I was taking whiskey on a full stomach. Or like Michael said, felt reassured that I ate some chicken and now it ain't going to hurt me. You know, they told you, remember that? Line your stomach with grease and you can, you know. So it sounds like Jim was insane at this moment. The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured in more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried it again. Jim's off to the races. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering, like pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, which drinking always caused him. Not sometimes caused him. Always caused him these things. He had every reason not to do it, yet he did it. Insane. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. They 12-stepped him. Yet all the reasons for drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion... That's a great definition of the ability to think straight be called anything else.
That's, I'm done.
You're done? All right. Hey, you gotta love Jim, but I don't understand that whiskey and milk deal. That is insane, no matter how you look at it. Says you may think this is an extreme case. To us, it's not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day we had asked ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how could it have happened? How did it happen? Jim used the part of his body that was broken, his head. Anybody ever seen that sign up on the wall in AA rooms, that think, think, think? My sponsor looked at me and he said, that one is not for you. That is not for you. My thinker's broken. Old Jim, how well did his thinker do for him? Not too good. Not too good. Oh, boy. Wow. So much fun. The insane idea one, okay, here we go. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. And yeah, there are a couple ways to go out drinking. Let's face it. Jim didn't go out deliberately. Some people would say, oh, Jim set himself up the minute he walked into that place because they had a bar. Go do the research. He didn't. He didn't. I hate to break it to you, that was not a trigger what Jim walked into. He walked into a surrounding he was familiar with. It was something that he had been to many times. He didn't deliberately walk in there to get drunk. Suddenly came calling and he was screwed. But there's also ways that we go out where we just fly that, how do you put it? The effort flag. Anybody ever flown that flag before where you just go out and Jim Bill talked about it, that drinking for oblivion. And we have all these reasons why we do it. But even in this type of beginning, we're obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely sufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. No matter what, we downplay it, don't we? Once that fear has gone away, once that certain time has come up and that suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago, we'll start downplaying it in our head. No, it isn't going to happen. This time I've got a plan that's foolproof. You know, it just never happens right. This next story, I'll never forget the first time I'm reading this book by myself, and I read this story, and I am like, what is this? Why is this in the book? Let's check it out. Our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you label him a foolish chap with queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he is slightly injured several times in succession. How many? I could have swore the stretch in the 90s, that had to be the longest stretch of bad luck anyone has ever had. That's what I had going. I just had a run of bad luck. And, you know, here's this old jaywalker, you know. He gets injured. Oh, it was just an unlucky day. I shouldn't have been jaywalking. You'd expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he is hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. Things are getting serious for this guy, isn't it? Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. And the only question I have to that is, how fast can a trolley car go? I always wondered that. He tells you he had decided to stop jaywalking for good and for all. What's that? The old jaywalker's making the firm resolution, isn't he? I'm never going to do it again. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, his conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. First, he's going to control it. Then he's not going to do it at all. The continual promises. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and he's held up to ridicule. The injuries come in, even more, not only physical, but other things. He tries every known means of getting the jaywalking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum. He goes to jaywalking treatment centers, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? And the first time I read that, I'm like, what is this all about? And then it all started to become very clear. Look what it says. You may think this illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substitute alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. Now, when I go up, if I were to tell you my story, mine is as foolish as that jaywalker. You take jaywalking out, you put Michael in there with alcohol, and there's my story. To a T. It fits it exactly. Yet we want to laugh it off. No, that it isn't the same. That's just crazy what that jaywalker's doing. It's different when it comes to me. All that self-rationalization comes in. You know, it says, where are we at? However intelligent we may have been with in other respects where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? And we're right back to, have you ever wondered why people look at you the way they do? As you're coming off your last debacle. They're looking at that jaywalker. That's what our poor family members, friends, co-workers, employers are looking at. This silly fool that keeps running out in front of fast-moving vehicles and gets busted up every time. There it is. It says, some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us, these things cannot happen. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. I'll never forget the first time I went to treatment. I get roomed up with this guy. And this guy, we sit down the first night, and he starts telling me his story, and I look over at him, and I'm like, you really need to be here. Oh, my God. And I'm thinking to myself, you did what? And he keeps going on, and I'm thinking to myself, my God, if I ever got that bad, I'd stop. Man, you need to be here. I'm just trying to get the heat off. The girlfriend said she's going to leave me. I'm in treatment trying to keep her at bay. Fast forward down the years. My life made that guy's life look like a walk down a garden path. You know, but here's exactly where I was. I don't intend on going as far as you do. Thanks for the information. That is not going to happen to me. Says that may be true to certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. How many times have they told this? This is a reoccurring thing. The knowledge that Jim found did not save him. I believe, let me get the facts right, isn't Jim Dr. Bob's son-in-law? Last I checked. You go back through the history.
Jim was Claire Snyder's son-in-law.
I thought it was, it could be either or, but he was 12-stepped by the source. He had as much knowledge as you could possibly obtain. Was it able to keep him sober? No. Self-knowledge isn't going to fix it. This is a point we wish to emphasize and reemphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers that has been revealed to us out of our bitter experience. Not out of their opinions, but out of their experience. Let us take another illustration, and we're getting to, if you want to know what a 12-step call is supposed to be like, take notes. If you want to know what an old-time 12-step call is all about when it came to old-school Alcoholics Anonymous, here it is. It is picture-perfect. Let's check it out. I love Fred. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home. He is happily married and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he is an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in the hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. There we are again. A whole lot of nervous, jittery people back then. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was very much ashamed of it. You remember those first experiences that you had, whether it was your first visit to the jail or the first visit to your treatment center? Those weren't pleasant experiences. And here old Fred's sitting in the hospital for the first time. Fred's a high-bottom drunk. Everything's going well in life except for this drinking thing's causing him some problems, and he ends up in the hospital, and he's really not too happy about what happened. He's pretty much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his
nerves.
How about that? The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. Go figure. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. Oh, there's Fred's firm resolution, isn't it? There it is. Let's mark it on the wall. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. What did the AAs do when they first met Fred? Underline this. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. They shared their experience and knowledge of the problem as they saw it. They laid it out in detail. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but was a long way from admitting that he could not do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. So you know what the AAs did? That's wonderful, Fred. But here's the deal. If you do have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, you will drink again. Here's our number. Give us a call if anything happens. If not, you're absolutely right. And they shook his hand, and you know what they did? They left. They laid out the problem. Fred didn't think he had that problem, and they said, okay, here you go, Fred, but if by chance you pick up another drink, here's our number. Have a nice day. Let's see where the story goes. We heard no more from Fred for a while. One day we were told he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. How about that? Isn't that amazing? Fred's tune changed just a little bit, didn't it? The story he told was most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet he was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it was possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. They laid out that insanity. The second half of that first step, they hammered it. And if you want to know the whole tone for this chapter, it's the unmanageability part. That's what they're trying to drive home right here. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, in that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. Thanks for the information, right? Well, let's find out what happened. I felt I had every right to be self-confident that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. Sounds like a wonderful plan, doesn't it? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, Fred, and you can do it. Be a man. How many times have we ran that through our heads? And for you gals, I don't know what you pull yourself up by, but you know what I'm saying. It says, in this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks. Here's Fred beating himself on the chest. Look at me. I got this thing beat. You know what? Maybe I was making too hard a work at this alcohol problem. Think about it. We get some time separated from our last drink, and we're not drinking, and we think, you know what? I got this thing licked. How many times have you been there? Well, let's find out. I began to wonder as though I had been not making too hard a work of a simple matter. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during that particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Anybody hear that? Everything is going Fred's way. No trials, no low spots. Everything he's doing right now, he's successful at. He has no reason to drink that you could come up with, right? How about that? You'd think, you look back at Jim's story, and we can easily see, oh, Jim drank because that resentment. No, Jim drank because he's an alcoholic. That's why Jim drank. Let's find out what happened to Fred. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, Is anybody keeping track of this for a second? What got Bill that time in that bar? A telephone. We got a telephone. And it drives me crazy because in Jim's story, everyone says, well, Jim walked into a bar and it was a trigger. That's what got him drunk. And you hear this term, it's a trigger. Trigger's a horse. Trigger's a mechanical part on a gun. If we really believed in triggers, if you got brutally honest, guess what we have to add to a trigger list? Along with telephone. As I crossed the threshold of a dining room, the man walked through a doorway. The thought came to mind that it'd be nice to have a couple cocktails with dinner. Suddenly, old Fred screwed, just like Jim. You ever notice suddenly doesn't come with a calling card? It doesn't send you a note a week before, by the way, next week I'm going to be all over the top of you. About noon when you walk through that doorway, you're done. You're mine. There's no warnings. Where did that come from? Someone would say you'd have to have a horrible day in order to drink again. How did he describe it? It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon, and his mind came up with, let's drink. Where'd that come from? Came from the fact that Fred's an alcoholic. He's condemned to have that happen over and over again. He said, I have a couple cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered a cocktail in my meal, then I ordered another cocktail. Way to go, Fred. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me that a highball would be fine before going to bed. So I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. How many shadowy recollections do we all have? Oh, my God, that'd be a fun book to write, wouldn't it? Poor Fred. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with the unbearable mental and physical suffering. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what we're talking about. Fred's devastated one more time. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over the evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. Fred was screwed no matter what. No matter what happened, it could have been a bad day, a good day. It could have been a doorway. It could have been who knows. Suddenly came calling. At certain times, you're screwed, Fred. Hate to break it to you. All right. I had commenced to drink carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. How about that? What a perfect 12-step call. They planted the seed for Fred. Fred didn't accept it, but guess what? It happened, didn't it? They did their job. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. Underline that. My God. The moral of the story. I had never been able to understand people who said the problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Welcome to step one, Fred. There it is. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned. Anybody ever have that happen to you? God, that's miserable, isn't it? They're grinning. You're dying, falling, and shaking. Oh, my God, there's nothing worse. Which I didn't like so much. Me neither, Fred. I didn't either. And then they asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. I had conceded to both propositions. After he said, okay, uncle, I am, what did they do? Just like this book. The book tells you something, then it moves on to another subject and tells you about it, and then it knows who it's dealing with, an alcoholic, and they go back and tell you about what they told you the first time before they move on again. So they convinced Fred was screwed in step one, and you know what they did? Fred said, I am an alcoholic, and you know what they did? Then I love this part. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I had exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozens. They gave Fred the worst case of alcoholism Fred could ever dream of. They did their job. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. How about that complete deflation? There it is. They outlined the spiritual answer in a program of action which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. At some of these, we balk, don't we? I think about it. They laid it out to him, and he's like, ooh. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, step three, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it had proved to be. This is an amazing paragraph right here. This next one, how'd you like to hang your name on this one? Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I have lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back even if I could. Is that not awesome? And that's what this thing is all about. God, Fred, that was great. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had only felt the first nip of the ringer. Fred was a high bottom drunk, but that's okay because this thing isn't about bottoms. It's not external events. It's an internal condition that we have to reach in step one. We've got to be at that point. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. There I am. I wasn't like Fred. I had to be like that. It says, many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made the statement to some of us, "What you said about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you are 100% hopeless apart from divine help beyond human aid." There it is again. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I'd been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. Once more, the alcoholic, underline it, at certain times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. And we're going to learn all about that in the next chapter. Thanks. Where are we at? Take a break. And are you guys up for doing chapter 4?